from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. Investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond suffered from serious back pain for years. She tried treatment after treatment to no avail. So she turned her investigative eye toward the back pain industry. She found a landscape littered with ineffective treatments, ethically dubious pain clinics, pill mills, and widespread collusion and fraud. Back doctors and their clinics have helped fuel America's opioid addiction crisis, and too many people simply aren't getting any better. Catherine Jacobson Raymond joins us in studio to discuss her new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. That's next on Forum, after this hour's news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in this week for Michael Krasny. Welcome to Forum. In this hour, beware the back pain industrial complex. Many doctors say it's not a matter of if you'll experience back pain, but when. A recent NPR poll says more than half of all people have had a back pain episode in the last year. It's estimated nearly 80 million people suffer back pain every year. But are back doctors giving you the best advice and treatment based on the best medical evidence? Investigative reporter Catherine Jacobson Raymond says the answer is a resounding no. Jacobson Raymond found a slice of the American medical system that has gone very wrong, packed with charlatans, scammers, fraudsters, and greedy practitioners, fueling the opioid epidemic. And she found lots of well-intentioned people who, in the end, are simply not serving the best interests of their patients. It's a story, as she puts it, with more twists, turns, and corrupt characters than a John le Carré spy novel. And Catherine Jacobson Raymond joins us now to talk about the issue and her new book, Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. Welcome to Forum.
Thank you so much, Eric. I'm so pleased to be here.
Well, what made your book particularly compelling to me in reading it is that you combine, you know, your investigative journalistic skills while chronicling your own struggle finding a solution to your back pain problems. Tell us how and when you decided you wanted to dig deeper into what you call the back pain industry in America.
Mm-hmm. Well, Crooked is divided into two parts. Part one is problems and part two is solutions, which makes it kind of a hybrid. I began this hunt when I decided around 2007 that I absolutely had to do something about my situation because it was getting in the way of everything. And I tried physical therapy and exercise and chiropractic over years and years and years with really no substantial improvement. And when I started this hunt, I found that a lot of things didn't seem to add up. And then as an investigative reporter over years, I've discovered that when things don't add up, they just refuse to add up, there's usually something wrong. It's usually not me. But I had no idea how big a story I was falling into.
Well, no one is really spared here. Doctors, clinics, physical therapists, chiropractors. You found a disturbing amount of kind of collusion and conflict of interest throughout the industry. Tell us about that.
Well, I really did. I didn't understand how all of these parts linked up. I really didn't understand the role of, for instance, workers' comp and personal injury attorneys and how they were hooked into chiropractors and physicians and certain types of hospitals. As I looked, I just started to see these connections one right after another. Mm-hmm. I didn't get how pharmaceutical companies had really sold primary care doctors a bill of goods, convincing them that opioids were the way to manage back pain, which is a prevalent attitude during the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s, really until quite recently.
Mm. I mean, your book is a searing indictment of what you call the back pain industry, but also really of the American healthcare system. There's so much money to be made through what you describe as, you know, unnecessary surgeries, treatments that don't work, drugs that sort of cover up symptoms but don't really treat the cause. Tell us, for you personally, what in the end worked? Because you put your back pain woes in the past tense.
I do. I put them in the past tense, which doesn't mean that I don't have back pain episodes from time to time. But it is no longer a chronic problem for me. And what I learned after an awful lot of searching and a minor surgery that did not go very well and definitely did not help, what I learned is that one has to take responsibility. You will not find someone who can fix you. So when you're looking for, someone in a white coat who can change the situation for you, you're just not going to find that. You are going to have to take responsibility for it. And so for me, the solution was exercise and really changing the way that I thought about my back pain, understanding that hurt does not mean harm in this particular arena, which does not mean that it doesn't mean harm in other arenas. Mm. But for people with ordinary, what we call axial back pain, generally, you can continue to live an active life. You should continue. The most dangerous thing you can do for yourself is take to the couch or take to your bed or take to pain management. But of course, that is what most people do.
And the industry pushes the pain management part, and it's helped fuel the opioid epidemic, you argue. Talk about that.
Well, in the 1990s, there was a strong movement that linked pharmaceutical companies and primary care doctors. Pharmaceutical companies made a very serious and well-funded pitch to get primary care doctors to ask all their patients if they were experiencing any pain. Oftentimes, they were experiencing some back pain because it is a human condition. And the answer to that, from the primary care doctor's perspective, because of the active marketing from pharmaceutical companies, was to say, okay, well, we can take care of that pain. And the way that the pain was taken care of was usually first with a shorter acting painkiller like Vicodin, which is as addictive as all get out, followed by longer acting extended release painkillers such as oxycodone. We know how that ended. This is changing. It's changing drastically now. I don't think if you walked into your primary care doctor's office and said you had back pain that you would be given a prescription for painkillers, because what we've seen beyond the addictive properties is that they actually do not work for patients with back pain. They cause those patients to become very unmotivated, very sleepy. There's something called opioid-induced hyperalgesia, where the opioids themselves are generating the pain in the brain.
Wow. So it's ineffectual and in some cases can spark addiction.
And also this neurological generation of pain.
We're speaking with journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about her new book, Crooked, on the $100 billion back pain industry. We'd like to hear from you, whether you're a patient or practitioner. What's been your experience with this back pain industry? What's worked? What hasn't? Join the conversation at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. We want to hear from you. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org, or post them at kqed.org. And you chronicle doctors who are really too eager to perform back surgeries, and you don't have to be the coach of the world champion Golden State Warriors to know that, you know, some back surgery can and does go wrong. I mean, you mentioned in the book the problematic surgeries of Coach Steve Kerr and of golf great Tiger Woods. They're kind of emblematic, you argue, of a broader trend. Kerr, from what, you know, we know, has suffered excruciating headaches and fatigue, and it's affected his career, but he is hardly alone.
Well, he's hardly alone, and that really brings up an interesting point. One of the reasons that people think that back surgery is going to solve their problems is because in the athletic universe, the first thing that happens with important sports figures, if they suffer some back pain, is that they go see one of these very elite surgeons and they have surgery and it seems to, quote unquote, take care of it. We have to understand that those athletic individuals are highly, highly trained. They are in excellent condition and there's a lot of money riding on that. So for them, maybe it does make make sense because the money they're worth this year is not the money they're going to be worth next year if they aren't playing. Mm. For the rest of us, for people who have been deconditioned because their pain is so great that they have not been moving, not the same kind of situation, not the same kind of outcome. Now, Steve Kerr, it's a terribly sad situation. It's not necessarily evident that this surgery that he was supposed to have has caused his difficulties. He actually had a spinal fluid leak. That does happen as a side effect of a lot of surgeries. Usually, it's resolved quite quickly. In his case, it definitely has not been. And there's an elephant in the room because when there is a spinal fluid leak, there's a very strong possibility of a condition called arachnoiditis, which is something you definitely, definitely never want to have. It affects the entire central nervous system. It means that pain and scar tissue and more pain and more scar tissue will be generated for a very long time. It's usually considered a major, major problem that cannot be solved. I hope in his case it will be solved. It's not evident to me that it has been. Tiger Woods continues. I think he's had 4 surgeries now. Last time I looked, which was just a few months ago, he was an excellent example of someone who felt extremely hopeless about his future, that he had really been, he would never have had the surgeries had he known what the outcome would be.
Did you do any research into sort of non-fee-for-service health systems like in Europe or elsewhere? I mean, did the outcomes differ at all in terms of back treatment when the pay incentive is different?
Very much so. I traveled all over the world for this book, doing research in much of Europe, a lot of Asia. And in the UK, for instance, where fee-for-service, it kind of does exist, but in general, people don't take part in that. There's very, very little spine surgery in the UK. Which is not to say that painkillers are not being handed out. They certainly are. But in terms of spine surgery, it's rare. In Germany, there's a lot more spine surgery and there's a lot more damage. So wherever fee-for-service exists, of course, there's a perverse incentive. And I talk to many, many very reputable, eminent spine surgeons who tell me that patients make their way into their clinics. They don't want them there, but they get in there. And when they say to these patients, you know what? It's not for you. There's nothing I can do for you here. The patients respond, but doctor, what am I to do? Their hopelessness comes out. And eventually a physician will be found who will respond to that and who will agree to do surgery. There's a story I tell in the book, Jerome Groopman, the physician and New Yorker writer, was in his early 30s when he developed back pain. He was a marathon runner, and he looked everywhere for a surgeon in the LA area who would tell him that he would run again and he would run again soon. And after 6 surgeons turned him down, I think 5 turned him down, and the 6th one said, yes, I can get you back running in 6 weeks. He spent the next 19 years in extraordinary pain to the point where at times he had to lie on a gurney in his own laboratory.
19 years. We're talking with journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond about her new book, Crooked, on the $100 billion back pain industry and the money that's being spent on treatments that she says are oftentimes ineffectual. Give us a call. Join the conversation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. We've got a lot of calls. And Katie in Palo Alto, you're on Forum. Welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm a daily listener of Forum, and I appreciate the programming you always have. It's so informative. I am just calling because I am a younger, younger patient with back pain that's been chronic since the age of 18, and I underwent surgery now as a medical student, turning around from the other side of things. And personally, to me, I've found the biggest thing that's helped me is just the minor daily changes. And of course, I can't speak for the entire patient population, but it's just so interesting what you're saying, and I'm interested in reading your book now. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your call. And Michelle in Eugene, you're on the air. Welcome to Forum.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is such an important topic. I had chronic back pain for about 20 years. I spent unknown amounts of dollars, probably tens of thousands of dollars. And the one thing that actually really helped me was the free thing, which was changing my posture. And there are tons of resources on YouTube about how to, you know, adjust your office chair properly and have good ergonomics and sit in a way that you're not slumping over and kind of hanging on your ligaments. I'd recommend doing a search for posture makeover, but there's just tons of great free resources out there.
Well, thank you for your call and your comment. But in your book, Catherine, I mean, even the ergonomic industry comes in for some criticism as well. You see some charlatans lurking there as well. Talk about that.
Yes. Well, there is really quite a difference between working on your posture and relying on what I refer to as ergonomic smoke and mirrors. One of my chapters is called The Posture Mavens, and it looks at multiple ways of changing your gait, your stance, the way you sit. These are really ingrown patterns that, you know, for most of us have been around for decades. Maybe they began in your second grade classroom when you were crammed into a little tiny chair and you began to sit in a very peculiar way to get at least a degree of comfort, and they stay with you. So breaking those habits can be very tricky. It sounds like, Michelle, you were able to do so. Now, many of us rely heavily on, you know, new office chairs. And I write in the book that I had a stable of office chairs because as a writer, of course, I sit for a living, very important to me. And one after another, expensive office chairs parading through my office. And I found most of them to be not very good. Often they're very soft and squishy. Often they're built for 250-pound men. They were not so supportive. And I came to realize that what was needed, you could have a chair from Costco for $25 that kept you upright and in a good position. But really what was needed was to get up and move around. The best posture is the next posture. It always is true. Static sitting, as I describe in Crooked, is extremely dangerous for a person with chronic back pain or actually for anyone. So I think that knowing that you need to move is key.
Get up and move. Vig in Cupertino, you're on forum. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Vig. I'm actually a resident physician currently. I'm from Cupertino, California. So I just had a one statement, number one, and my question is, when you talk about chronic back pain, I'm assuming you're talking about musculoskeletal back pain, correct? I mean, you know, when you say chronic back pain, it could be due to a 100 different things, correct?
Right. That's certainly right, Vig. There are numerous causes for back pain, and in the book I look at those very closely because you do need to understand that if you've had a traumatic accident or you have a fever concurrent with that back pain, or if you are a person living with cancer, these things require immediate attention from your primary care doctor. If you develop a type of numbness called cauda equina syndrome, where the interior inside of your thighs, your groin become numb, or you lose bowel or bladder control, these do require attention. However, what I am writing about is chronic, ordinary back pain, the kind that most people experience.
Hmm. And Vic, did you have
Thank
a question
you.
As well?
Yeah, and then my other question was, you know, I'm a general medicine, internal medicine resident, and we see a lot of back pain patients quite often in the clinic. And, you know, nowadays for the chronic back pain that you're talking about, there's generally an algorithmic approach on how you handle these. You know, you, as you said, you treat patients with anti-inflammatories and then physical therapy, and then from there you do further investigation. Have you seen, at least that's in our clinic, have you seen things like that happen more often, or do you support sort of an algorithmic approach, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there's a very serious danger in medicalizing back pain because it is not really a medical condition. And the more treatments, interventions that go on, the more medicalized it becomes, if that makes some sense to you. for instance, treating with anti-inflammatories. I'm sure you're talking about Advil or Aleve. That can have a very beneficial effect over a very short period. But as you are aware, there are substantial risks involved in long-term treatments with high doses of anti-inflammatories. The most beneficial approach that I discovered over and over is a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy to change the way that people are thinking about their pain. They need to realize, and it's very difficult to realize this, that hurt does not mean harm, that they can continue to live their lives. So cognitive behavioral therapy and in combination with intensive exercise, usually in the hands of a type of cheerleader that I refer to in the book, in Crooked, as a back whisperer, someone who really understands the entire musculoskeletal strategy, how to keep people safe and yet build their muscles, balance their gaits, and make them more effective humans.
Part physical therapist, part personal trainer, someone who knows what they're doing to help you get up and move and
move
better.
That's right. Yeah. In the book I describe, we can put this online maybe, some of the certifications that a person with back pain ought to be looking for. Not all physical therapists are well suited to do this, but there are physical therapists with orthopedic certifications who are tremendous. Hmm. There are very, very well-trained physical therapists and also personal trainers. Many personal trainers are barely certified, and they are not good candidates for the job. It's also really important to consider what does this personal trainer know about you? Is this trainer does this trainer think that a 60-year-old person should do what a 30-year-old person would do in the gym? That's generally an error. So we can put some of these online.
We'll try to put some up on the forum website for sure. And we're getting a lot of comments on social media. Brad writes, a poorly understood factor underlying cause of back and joint pain is clogged arteries. If people took better care of their cholesterol levels, there would be a significant reduction in these problems. End quote from Brad. And that gets to maybe your issue about exercise. And at the end of the day, this is related to a broader set of health style, lifestyle changes.
Well, yes. I mean, certainly a good diet is very important because clogged arteries, a lot of things are related to clogged arteries. You're likely to have a stroke and be dead. That's more related to clogged arteries. Basically, people who don't take care of themselves, who smoke cigarettes, who are obese, who have spent an enormous amount of time sitting in cars, on sofas, in the dining room, and then at work, those people have back problems. Not to say that you can't be incredibly athletic like Tiger Woods and still have them.
Lots more to talk about. Chiropractors, spine surgery, opioid addiction. Welcome to Forum, Catherine Jacobson. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back after a short break. Her new book is Crooked on the $100 billion back pain industry. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Eric Westervelt. We're talking with journalist Catherine Jacobson Raymond about her new book, Crooked: Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. It's a $100 billion industry, and the money, she argues, is not always being spent well on the right treatments. Chiropractors come in for significant criticism in your book. You point out that some, and I want to emphasize the word some chiropractors are completely ineffectual and others are doing things right. Talk about that.
Well, it's so interesting because, of course, people swear by their chiropractors. You hear that all the time. And I always wondered what that meant because, swearing by something sort of implies an act of faith. But what I learned here was that there are chiropractors who are doing a great job. They're doing a great job because they are no longer pursuing traditional chiropractic techniques. They have stopped adjusting. They have stopped seeking vertebral subluxations, which don't actually exist on any x-ray or any other type of scan. And they have moved on to a very excellent practice of physical rehabilitation. They may ultimately be a back patient's best hope because they have studied exercise science and they've really worked hard on it. There's a practitioner in Los Angeles named Craig Liebenson, and he makes a living teaching chiropractors how to rehab backs without adjusting anyone. Hands-on. That's not what you're looking for here. Now, in terms of traditional chiropractic, when you go and see a chiropractor, one session, maybe two sessions for a problematic back. After that, you are wasting your time if you're being cracked, adjusted, you know, climbed over, whatever. It is not a useful practice. And I'm not simply saying that. Study after study after study has showed that long-term visits to chiropractors don't help back patients. They're not prophylactic. Hmm. They don't help prevent back pain. They don't help solve back pain. Once again, one or two sessions could be helpful. But the World Health Organization has come up with a very long list, which I mention in Crooked, showing all of the diagnoses for which chiropractic is contraindicated. Hmm. And it's practically anything that would take you to a chiropractor. So it's a little surprising to see, for instance, disc herniation. Well, how many out there have been diagnosed with disc herniation? That is one of the World Health Organization's contraindications for visiting a chiropractor.
Right. I remember one story in your book, the construction worker has this herniated disc. He goes to a chiropractor and the treatment really shouldn't have been done at all. And he ends up a lot worse than before.
He does. It happens. More often, nothing happens, but particularly chiropractors who insist upon neck adjustments, as you'll read in Crooked, those are to be avoided really at all costs. There is no reason to let a chiropractor anywhere near your neck.
Let's go to the phones again. Kathy in San Jose, you're on Forum. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yep, you're on the air.
Okay, good. Catherine, I'm so glad you wrote this book. You're telling my story.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that, Kathy.
No, I am great now, and you're telling everything that I've wanted to tell the world, and I'm so glad.
Oh,
so,
bravo.
Yes, my problem was caused from sitting at a desk for many hours a day for many years, for doing competitive ballroom dancing and working with a dance instructor who did not understand proper posture, who really through his efforts had flattened my lower back. I lost the lower curvature in my back. My buttocks, the glutes had atrophied, and I had what a physical therapist described to me as a pelvic girdle collapse. I had been to a chiropractor who said I needed to see her every week for the rest of my life. I was going to acupuncturist for pain control. My medical doctor said that all she could do for me was give me a painkiller, and I wasn't going to buy any of that. I knew there had to be a solution.
Kathy, what ultimately worked for you? What worked for you?
I'm going to tell you. I found a, I call him a muscle balancer. She calls him a muscle whisperer, I think, or back whisperer. He does muscle balancing. So he worked on strengthening the weak muscles, and then stretching the tight ones. So my whole body got back in alignment. I got the curvature in the spine, and I've been out of pain for now 7 years.
A success story.
That's a great story, and it's a story I've heard many, many times in the 7 years it took for me to write Crooked, to research and write it. And it's really very true. You can be pushed into some extremely bad habits. I notice that most of the people who tell me about their chronic low back pain don't have significant gluteal development. Their backside, which this means their backsides are flat as pancakes. Melons is more what you're after here, because people believe that the spine sort of holds itself up by some mysterious process, and this is actually not true. It is the muscles and the ligaments along the spine are very important, and the glutes and the thighs are very, very important also. And if those are underdeveloped or deconditioned, back pain is often the result.
We're getting a lot of questions and comments coming in on social media. Kay writes, I started having back issues a few years ago and started doing yoga regularly, and I've had no issues since then. Do you have experience with yoga, and what are your thoughts about that? You addressed it a little bit in the book. Talk about yoga for that. Kay.
Kay, well... Yes, I do have quite a bit. There's a large chunk of a chapter in the book that talks about yoga. It talks about different types of yoga. And there are some tremendous benefits, certainly. One of the risk factors is finding yourself in a very competitive Northern California yoga class where you are pushed to do what you really cannot do. And most of us who are even remotely competitive will experience that. Well, this woman, who's actually a little older than I am, slightly to my right over here, has just done 9 sun salutations. I think I can do 9. Well, maybe you can and maybe you can't. If you actually have back pain, there are definitely going to be limitations about what you are capable of doing in a yoga class. And the most important thing you can have is a teacher who is experienced and has enough depth to give you variations on postures. I did find that Iyengar yoga and Vinny yoga were two of the best types for back pain patients because both of them have a very powerful orthopedic focus. I would be very, very careful about finding yourself in a flow yoga class where things are moving very fast and there is no way that the teacher can really keep a close eye on you. You need a teacher who will be absolutely attentive to what is going on with you.
And a question from Bryce that is near and dear to my heart. What is your view on standing desks? I know I like it. It's a big change and I love it, but... Is it another smoke and mirrors I should be scared of?
Well, I talk about standing desks in the book, and yes, it's a nice variation from sitting. But remember that if you're standing, you are putting tremendous pressure on possibly different set of ligaments, but still you're asking your ligaments to hold you up for a really extended period of time. And what we're seeing is all kinds of problems related to standing desks now. Hmm. They tend to be knee and hip problems more than low back problems, but they are still orthopedic problems. And if you end up with knee problems or hip problems, you will soon also have low back problems because, oddly enough, all these parts of the body are actually tied together. One of the things I really I dwell on is the fact that your best posture, as I said before, is your next posture. So you want to be moving. You do not want to be static for any length of time. I did try a standing desk. I liked it. It was pretty good. But what I liked the most was a treadmill desk. Huh. I liked that so much I almost bought one until I realized that I simply did not have the motor skills to be able to walk and think at the same time and that I might be able to have a nice chat with a friend while I was walking on my treadmill standing desk for, you know, multiple thousands of dollars. But I couldn't think or see well enough to actually write anything.
Well, beware the standing desk. That's a bearer of some harsh news for me there.
Well, I think it's perfectly viable, but you have to step down and go for a walk or get back to your chair or turn around or, you know, move your body and be in a chair that allows for that. And the way that chairs have been designed over the years to preserve a very static 90-90-90 posture, there's a story in my book about how that came to be. And it has absolutely nothing to do with benefiting your spine. It is simply the way that typists could most effectively hit the keys. If any of you out there can remember when there were typewriters, you really had to pound that sucker, right? And in order to have the force, you needed to be in that position. We no longer need to work in that position, and we should be able to move around as much as possible.
Goes back to some outdated science and research. Let's take some more phone calls. Valerie, you're on the air. Welcome to the program.
Hi there, Catherine. Thank you. Invaluable information. Thank you for doing this research. I can't wait to get your book and share it with my family.
Wonderful.
I'm calling for, two questions. My mother is 88. She had a really awful accident when she was in her 60s. Was miraculously pretty pain-free until recently. She had what you were describing, problems with opioids, had a very frightening overdose. Now we've gotten her, we think, in a good place with a pain management person, and I wanted to ask you about two things that she's on. Gabapentin, the long-acting, slow-release nerve pain medication, and lidocaine patches. And then the other question I wanted to ask for myself is inverted cables, and if you think there's any benefit to the use of those. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call, Valerie. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Valerie. Interestingly, there have been some studies published recently about gabapentin, which is basically a drug that is used to calm down an overactive nervous system. The new studies are not good. They do not show it to be effective. It has substantial side effects. Drowsiness is one of those. And I would say that, as you know, I'm not a physician, I'm an investigative reporter, and I don't prescribe anything for anybody. But for an 88-year-old woman, gabapentin is a highly questionable drug. Lidocaine patches are probably not very effective either, because this is not an injury of any recent duration. Your mom is 88. There's a practice called Feldenkrais, F-E-L-D-E-N-K-R-A-I-S, that is just tremendous. It's tremendous for anyone, but it's absolutely wonderful for older people who are perhaps not that flexible or able to move, you know, quickly. And there are Feldenkrais classes that Kaiser Permanente gives, very inexpensive. They allow a person to develop some more mobility and balance, and it's really, really good stuff.
Feldenkrais. Could you talk about what is that?
Feldenkrais is a type of movement. Mm-hmm. It's discussed in the chapter of my book called Posture Mavens. And it basically allows a person to find new ways of moving. As I think I mentioned, we get stuck in postures. These are ingrained at a very young age. I think, as I said, by second grade, they're ingrained. So changing any of that, changing the way we move, very difficult. And getting out of pain has a lot to do with changing the way we move. So Feldenkrais is mostly done on large, comfortable mats. It's very quiet. It's very gentle. But it allows a patient to mobilize joints and move in different ways, find new ways to have the body involved in movement. And it's very safe. It's absolutely safe. There is no way you can hurt yourself in a Feldenkrais class.
And as Valerie mentioned, her mother, I believe, had a bad opioid experience.
Yeah.
And here's a headline on NPR.org from Friday night. Poll finds doctors still prescribing lots of opioids for low back pain. And as we've talked about, I mean, this opioid therapy has really helped launch a public health crisis. Let's go back to the phones right now. Jeff in Santa Rosa, you're on the air. Jeff, are you with us?
Oh, yeah. I lost you for a second there. Can you hear me?
Welcome to Forum. You're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, I have a comment, actually. I'm a physician. I'm a gastroenterologist.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to commend Catherine on she's doing a great public service to everybody about this. I had a personal experience with back pain, with actually a spinal stenosis. And I want to implore the importance of proper patient selection when you're going to have surgery. I don't want the public to get the idea that if you have back pain, you should never have surgery. There are indications for having surgery.
Yeah.
But a radiculopathy or pain down the legs and in the buttocks and with muscle weakness are important symptoms to be cognizant of. I felt for years that I would never have surgery myself because I saw so many patients with failed back syndrome on chronic narcotics. They were sent to me for constipation and all kinds of problems. But proper selection, patient selection, and proper surgeon selection. My surgeon was fantastic. I would not operate on you if you don't have radicular pain. If you had back pain, you're not getting an operation. He's salaried at University of California, San Diego, and he is not financially motivated. And I think it's one of the things to consider in our overall health delivery system.
Jeff, thanks a lot. I mean, in Jeff's case, it worked, back surgery. But in your book, you argue strongly this should be a last resort and done correctly, and it's being done too often by people who aren't qualified to do it.
Right. Well, what Jeff is talking about, first of all, he mentioned that he had spinal stenosis, which would be a very unusual reason to have surgery unless there were some other factors involved. He seemed to also say that he had significant pain down his leg. That's what radiculopathy is, by the way. For people who think it might be ridiculous, radiculopathy means nerve pain.
It shoots down into your legs.
Typically, it can go other places. You can have pain in your hands, in your arms. It depends on where the nerve is being compressed. So in his case, I would imagine that nerve was released typically by removing a bit of bone from the spine so that the nerve could run more freely. It can be effective, but, and this is a huge but, it is not going to be effective if there is no rehab that goes with it. And the gross majority of back pain patients either are never informed that they need to go into post-op rehab to build the muscles that they are now missing and the muscles that have generally been damaged in the course of the surgery. Because I watched a lot of spine surgeries. I stood in the OR. I've seen what happens. When they go in there, they are going through layer after layer of muscles, as many as 9 layers, and the damage will be considerable. It will require rehab. The indications for surgery with spinal stenosis are not great. I mean, the outcomes are typically not great, and I discuss that in detail in the book. I'm really glad that it worked for Jeff, that's for sure.
Well, you do have a chapter in your book where you tell some nightmarish stories of people's experience with what's known as minimally invasive spine surgery in a company called the Laser Spine Institute. You write that these procedures too often are insanely expensive and very risky. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, there are many, many companies in the United States now that sell something that they call minimally invasive spine surgery or laser spine surgery. If you Google spine surgery or even spine, they will come up very high in the results. They are spending tremendous amounts of money to get there. And the problem with this is that these are sexy buzzwords. Minimally invasive spine surgery. Okay, yes, perhaps the incision is small. What goes, and it isn't always, because I have one on my back and it's about 3 inches wide, which is just the same size the incision would have been if I did not have minimally invasive spine surgery. But if, in fact, you do have a small incision, good for you. You might look better in a bathing suit. The damage beneath the skin will be exactly the same as it would be in regular, traditional, conventional spine surgery. It's a marketing term.
Well, and you write that this direct-to-consumer approach to medicine and its aggressive internet marketing, you know, it sort of exists in a regulatory netherworld.
It does. It's very unregulated because these procedures occur in ambulatory surgery centers, which are, by their very nature, very unregulated. And if anything goes wrong afterwards, you're not in a hospital environment. There's no way for you to be taken care of. I talked to multiple owners of these facilities, and some of the stories that come out of there are really chilling. People who have been harmed, and the harm is much worse because there's no way to intervene on it since you're not in a medical facility. You're in somebody's, basically in somebody's back office.
We've only got a minute before we have to go to a break, but a good question from Michelle. Can you address how emotions affect the book? And you have a whole chapter on that, the emotional link, briefly.
Mm-hmm. That chapter is called Head Case, which certainly is not meant to imply that we're all crazy. But there is an extremely tight link between the pain you feel in your back and what is going on from a neurological perspective. It's complicated. It's chemical. I don't anticipate that the ordinary average reader is going to be too fascinated by what neurotransmitters are involved here. But believe me when I tell you that there is a phenomenon called central sensitization that occurs when the brain takes over and begins generating pain that no longer is coming from the so-called site of the injury. Now, mind you, that injury that we're talking about may have occurred while you were brushing your teeth and turning off the water. So it's often not much of an injury at all.
We're speaking with author, investigative journalist Catherine Jacobson-Raymond. Her new book is Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry and Getting on the Road to Recovery. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio San Francisco. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Eric Westervelt. And Catherine, it's not all doom and gloom. Let's talk solutions in your chapter, The Back Whisperer. I mean, you have one story in this book where a chiropractor sort of sees the light and changes how he treats people. He realizes that what patients need really is intensive exercise meant to build, you know, ability, strength, and confidence to try to get people long-term the strength and agility they need to continue living full, successful lives.
Well, I had to make a decision here because I wanted to represent both halves of this story. The first part of the book is called Problems, and the second part is called Solutions. And you can read them in either order. And I know that a lot of people are going straight to solutions because they definitely intend to find out about the problems, but first, they'd like to feel better. And I do talk about back whisperers and posture mavens. Both are critical figures in recovery. You cannot really expect someone to fix you. It does not work that way. But what you do need is somebody to supervise you, somebody to push you, somebody to encourage you to believe that if you do this thing, if you move these weights, if you do this type of exercise and you do two or three sets of it and you feel kind of like garbage by the third one, that you are actually going to be okay. So you're looking for people with the right kind of experience. And as I noted before, there are certain certifications that will help you get there. What I do very often, I do Stuart McGill's Big Three. This is a very simple set of exercises. Every single time someone comes to me and says, you know what, my back's killing me, what should I do? The first thing I do is send them right to my website to the resource section. You can pop it into the box, Stuart McGill, up comes the video. You can see the exercises. Simple as pie, as long as you don't cheat. And most back pain patients cheat like crazy because they're trying to avoid using the muscles that are weak and painful. If you avoid using those muscles, you're not going to get better, so don't cheat.
Online, John writes, I'm 6'3". I had shocking back pain until my doctor noticed my flat feet and recommended arch supports. No back pain since. It's been almost 30 years now. Another success story from John. And Stephen writes, are there appropriate treatments for sciatica that are different than other types of musculoskeletal back pain? Can you address that?
Yes, I can. John, you know, clinical studies have not shown benefit for orthotics. And yet I know that people do see a lot of improvement. I am wondering if the real basis for that improvement is they get the orthotics and it's more comfortable to walk and move. So they walk and they move more, and therefore they recover. I also have very flat feet, although exercise has changed that. And it is important to realize that, you know, flat feet, you're not stuck forever with flat feet. If you're born that way, and you're inclined not to be athletic, but if you can build up the muscles in your calves and your ankles and your feet, you won't have flat feet anymore. It's not an endless structural problem. It can be redeemed, and it actually does make a difference. In terms of treatments for sciatica, I don't know what treatments you've undergone thus far. What I do understand is that most people and many physicians misinterpret sciatica. The term means a compression of the sciatic nerve. It comes out of your spine between L4 and L5. Anything else you have is not actually sciatica. And it's my suspicion that the gross majority of people who think they have sciatica are not actually dealing with a compression of that sciatic nerve. What they have, at least not when it exits the spine, what is going on instead is that muscles in the glutes, in the thigh, have contracted and contracted hard on that nerve. And it is a matter of retraining those muscles. A metaphor that I use is that when your muscles feel like your spine is in jeopardy, they panic and they hang on for dear life. And getting them to let go, not so simple. The Stuart McGill exercises go a long way to do that.
We're running out of time. Unfortunately, a lot of calls we're probably not going to get to, but we are getting some pushback both online and in the calls from listeners who say, look, I need opioids for my severe back pain. I rely on them. They're the only thing that's sort of giving me some relief. Your response to that?
I know that that is a real problem, and I sympathize greatly. But what I also know from reading all the literature for 7 years is that it is not the solution. Opioids are frequently used when patients suffer from depression. The lack of motivation is profound. And finding another way, I do talk in the book about ways to get past opioids and move on. And I really hope that you'll take a look at
Crooked. We're out of time. Catherine Jacobson Raymond, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Her new book is Crooked, Outwitting the Back Pain Industry. I'm Eric Westervelt, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Thanks for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.